Israel opens up border crossings for aid delivery in Gaza a day after the U.S. threatens continued aid.
These are positive developments, but the real test is results. And that's what we're looking to see in the coming days and in the coming weeks.
As starvation sets in, humanitarian groups are reassessing their ability to safely deliver aid following the deaths of their World Central Kitchen colleagues this week.
The situation is absolutely horrific. There is a constant fear of bombs essentially falling on your head, right? I heard it during the night. You feel the guesthouse shaking.
And growing concern over escalating tensions between Israel and Iran. Today is Saturday, March 6th. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hello there, I'm Lori London in Washington. Amid widespread global outrage over a drone strike this week that killed 7 aid workers delivering food, Israel opened more aid delivery routes into Gaza Friday and said it would take more steps to increase the flow of humanitarian aid. The announcement came a day after U.S. President Joe Biden, in a phone call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, threatened a shift in policy, making U.S. aid to Israel conditional on concrete measures to avoid civilian and aid worker casualties. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
These are positive developments, but the real test is results. And that's what we're looking to see in the coming days and in the coming weeks. Is the aid effectively reaching people who need it throughout Gaza? Are the bottlenecks and other delays at crossings being resolved? Do we have a much better system for deconfliction and coordination so that the humanitarian workers, the folks who are delivering the aid, can do it safely and securely? All of these things are critical, and that needs to, again, really be measured by the results.
Israel also dismissed two officers and reprimanded three others, saying they mishandled critical information and violated the Army's rules of engagement. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, in remarks Friday, said that while he appreciated the Israeli government acknowledging the mistakes,
I sincerely hope that these announced intentions are effectively and quickly materialized, because the situation in Gaza is absolutely desperate.
As Israel continues its war on Hamas, it's becoming increasingly more diplomatically isolated. Could this be a catalyst to a shift in U.S. policy and also a change in Israel's war strategy? Joining us to discuss is former U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Edward Djerejian, Senior Fellow with the Middle East Initiative at Harvard Kennedy Belford Center.
I don't think it signals a real policy shift for the United States, because the president's phone call with Netanyahu from the readouts we got, it's basically addressing the humanitarian disaster in Gaza after the horrific attacks on October 7th and the huge and overreaction of the Israeli military in helping create this humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, and the not only American public opinion, but world opinion increasingly opposed to Israel's conduct of the war. And the administration is feeling the pressure both domestically, as we know, and also globally. The administration is reacting to the actual situation on the ground and to growing public opposition to Israel's conduct of the war. And these concrete measures that you referred to, they may be concrete measures, but they're addressing the symptoms. They're not addressing the cause of the conflict. And that's what needs to be addressed, in my mind, is a strategic reassessment of the situation in Gaza and actually taking a hard look at our relationship with Israel in terms of the Netanyahu government's policies, which have proven to be, in my mind, a real failure. Netanyahu's policy of deterrence against Hamas, allowing Hamas to be financed from the outside to divide the Palestinian leadership and the Palestinian Authority, and frankly, to defer having to make any hard decisions on negotiations for a two-state solution, which Netanyahu and his government opposed in their declared statement when they formed the government in December. All of this policy has failed. And therefore, when you talk about whether this is a shift in American policy, we're talking about the critical issue, yes, of aid, but it's not dealing with the real substance of the issue. So I don't see any real U.S. reassessment of policy, which I think is sorely needed toward the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But I see that the administration is preparing to take more specific, harder steps on aid deliveries and conditioning perhaps some of the quality of the armaments that are being supplied to Israel during this time.
Right. There are lots of calls, including from the UN and many Americans, that the U.S. stop sending weapons. Do you think the U.S. potentially will get to that point if things don't improve rapidly?
Well, I think that since the Netanyahu government and the prime minister himself virtually stubbed their nose at the administration's approaches on the scope of the humanitarian disaster as a result of the ongoing IDF operations and the prospect of the IDF moving into Rafah, where there are approximately 1.3 million Gazans, where are they going to go? The administration is insisting on safe haven and getting these civilians out of harm's way. But we have not seen, in my eyes, from my perspective, I have not seen a credible Israeli plan for the relocation of the citizens of Gaza to conduct such an operation. When Israel has such a plan and announces it, for example, say the redeployment of the Gazan civilians to another part of Gaza, then maybe there's something to consider in terms of accommodating U.S. pleas for avoiding yet a deepening humanitarian crisis in Gaza by IDF operations in Rafah. But I haven't seen, nor do I think the administration has seen, a definitive Israeli plan for redeployment. And frankly, if one can speculate, Hamas is looking at all of this, and if they don't see a civilian relocation plan, they may be saying, well, Israel's not going to attack now. So to answer your question, a presidential call to the prime minister of Israel that results in the Eretz crossing to be reopened, and maybe another one, to me is an insufficient result of a presidential approach to the state of Israel. The United States should be asking for all land crossings to be opened, for full humanitarian supplies, food and medicinal and all these other requirements. Before October 7th, there are approximately, to my knowledge, 400 trucks that would enter into Gaza per day. Get at least to that. And the road system is the best system. This port and all these parachute drops are marginal.
What leverage should, in your view, the U.S. take to make that happen? The president has also apparently told the prime minister there needs to be an immediate ceasefire. If they're still bombing and we're still potentially sending weapons, what other leverage does the U.S. have?
The president has a great deal of leverage over the state of Israel. Our relationship, Israel's an ally. We have such close relationships at every possible level. And so the president could use the leverage of the United States in international organizations like the UN, maybe not abstain from a resolution, but to not veto a resolution on these issues as they come up. That's public diplomacy. That's very important. Israel is isolating itself. It's putting itself on the back foot of international public opinion. It's no longer David and Goliath. It's reversed the perception. And therefore, we should not be aiding and embedding this Israeli government's policies that are putting Israel in a more vulnerable position, first of all. And secondly, it doesn't serve U.S. interests. So using the public diplomacy and international organizations and our relations with other regional partners in the international community, like the EU, that's one thing. The second thing is conditioning our assistance at every level, including military. Don't equip Israel with 2,000-pound bombs that are really devastating impact on the civilians of Gaza. This takes nothing away from what Israel suffered on October 7th on the attacks in Israel. But I think the most intelligent public statement I've heard from this administration was earlier on by the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, and I think it was prescient. He said, in this kind of fight, the center of gravity is the civilian population. And if you drive them into the arms of the enemy, you replace a tactical victory with a strategic defeat. And this is what I think Israel is looking at right now.
With 6 months into the war, no end in sight, and of course, this mounting pressure from international allies that we've been talking about, even before the attack on the aid workers, there started to be mass protests against the Netanyahu government from his own citizens, and that has now been joined by families of the hostages. Their frustration level, there are no words for what they're feeling and the fear that they're having as every day goes by. How does that factor in? You have a growing population that is very unhappy with the way things are, and they're very, very unhappy that the hostages are not a priority as well.
Well, I think one of the reasons for the crisis within the body politic of Israel is because there is a perception that the prime minister of Israel, Netanyahu, has not given the priority that people expect on the hostage release, and that the instructions that he's given to his negotiating team has not been strong enough to accommodate various political compromises that are going to be needed to get the hostages out. And so that is a real problem. And any ceasefire has to be linked to the release of the hostages. And there are big political game it has to be played out, where Hamas is asking for the release of Palestinian political prisoners and in exchange for the release of the Israeli hostages. And the instructions that Netanyahu gives to his negotiating team have, at least from the outside — we're not in the negotiations, we don't know exactly what's being negotiated — but there's a perception that he hasn't given his negotiating team enough scope to really get an agreement on the hostages. Hamas is obviously asking for maximal positions, but that's where you have the United States, you have Egypt, you have the international community that is lending their shoulder to get a compromise worked out where the hostages will be released and there'll be a ceasefire leading to a sustainable ceasefire. So that's one reason why there's all this turmoil in Israel, and rightfully so, because of the fate of the hostages. The second thing is that Israel putting so many different conditions on the supply of humanitarian assistance to Gaza over the past months has just deepened. Netanyahu is a very weak reed to lean on, because he's dependent for his political survival on the extreme messianic Zionist constituencies in his coalition. All these people have no interest compromising adequately to get to the solutions we've been talking about, and they are proponents of annexation and the expansion of the Israeli settlement project. So this is not a government that is going to be able to find the roadmap to a conflict resolution, in my view. Therefore, the Israelis are asking for early elections, and let there be early elections. And we also need elections in the Palestinian constituency, in the Palestinian Authority. We need elections on both sides to bring forward possibly and hopefully leadership that will be able to move from conflict management to conflict resolution.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Israel Edward Djerinjian, Senior Fellow with the Middle East Initiative at Harvard Kennedy Belford Center. Among the World Central Kitchen staffers killed this week was Jacob Flickinger, a dual citizen of Canada. His father, John Flickinger, spoke with CTV about what the work meant to his son.
He told me, "Dad, people are starving to death, and I can maybe help a little." And he knew there was a risk. He took it anyways when he found out they needed boots on the ground there. He died serving others. So
yeah,
we are very proud, and Canada should be proud of his service.
A record number of humanitarian workers have been killed in Gaza since the start of Israel's war on Hamas 6 months ago. This latest tragedy has prompted multiple charities to suspend food deliveries. Joining us to talk about what a pause in aid could mean for the thousands of Palestinians on the brink of starvation is Yanti Sirypto, president and CEO of Save the Children, who just returned from Gaza.
I was actually in Deir al-Balah on Tuesday as well, so very close to that area where the hits happened. And I saw firsthand how much their support, their humanitarian services are needed in, look, everywhere in Gaza, but also there in that area. We visited a community there, 600 people. They'd been displaced three times. They ended up there. It was close to the beach. They had literally one bath. I mean, I wouldn't even call it a bathroom. They had one hole in the ground that they were sharing with 600 people. They all had their stories of horror and loss and violence. Half of the children I saw had no shoes on. There was a lot of definitely underlying health problems, a lot of coughing, a lot of respiratory illnesses. Moms were telling us about diarrhea. For their children in particular, they were clearly malnourished. And still, one of those moms then said to me, after all of that, lack of food, lack of clean water, etc., she said, "But actually, I need mental health support more than I need food." Right? So that is the context and the overall situation that I certainly saw firsthand in Gaza. The loss of 7 lives, the total toll now for humanitarian workers stands at 196. It is by far the deadliest conflict in the world for many, many years in terms of loss of humanitarian workers killed either in doing their job or killed in their homes with their families, as one of our own colleagues did just before Christmas. And on top of that, of course, the death toll for children now stands at 13,000. I mean, and people at one point, they were concerned about this after 6 months of this, all these stories, all that footage of death and destruction and despair, it sort of blends into a bit of background we fear for people, because there's yet another incident in Gaza and people feel helpless to do anything about it, and the numbers start to be meaningless. But 13,000 children dead in one conflict in 6 months is an unbelievable number, right? 90% of the population being in phase three or worse in terms of food insecurity is an unbelievable record, a terrible record. So every week, terrible records are broken in Gaza, and not by a little bit, but the 196 humanitarians that lost their lives, that is three times as many as in any other conflict over these past decades. It was as bad as you would imagine seeing some of the footage. And I was mostly in Rafah and then in Deir al-Balah, which is essentially sort of a little closer to halfway up Gaza. So I didn't go into the north. It's been incredibly difficult for anybody to get access to the north of Gaza. It's been very difficult to get any aid into Gaza. We were very happy to see all of seven trucks of the World Food Program get back into the north, actually in the week that I was there. And we were sort of celebrating it as a win, even though we know that we need many, many more trucks to get in. But so the situation is absolutely horrific. And there is a constant fear of bombs essentially falling on your head, right? I heard it during the night. You feel the guesthouse shaking. You hear it as if it is next door. And in some cases, it was actually 200 meters away down the road. All of those trips that we make to various areas, either with convoy to deliver aid or to visit communities to understand their needs or to prioritize needs or to check on deliveries, all of those trips are made with huge care and caution, using intelligence, using the security cluster that is operating inside of Gaza with all of the agencies and the UN to understand, can we go? Can we send somebody there? Should we wait? Do we have to suspend? It's a constant fluid situation. Can we get the truck in? Can we not? So all that to say, you know, the fact that it happened is shocking, but it is certainly not the first event or incident where we've seen that the deconfliction mechanism isn't working and that there is an unbelievable, at best, disregard for protection of civilians.
Given the growing danger for aid workers and the conversation that humanitarian aid organizations are having now about protecting their own safety and the safety of their staffers, what kind of an impact for those that are just pausing, like the World Central Kitchen, how could that impact an already horrific humanitarian catastrophe where famine is looming?
Of course it's chilling. I mean, look, the fact that WCK suspended programs, as they, you know, completely understandably have done, and we would have done exactly the same had it happened to us, to understand what went wrong here. Can we put our staff at more risk? And that in and of itself, of course, has immediate effect, because those meals are not being served, you know, over these past number of days. And there is not that much else available for these communities. And for many communities, it's the only meal that they had a chance of getting. We are reviewing, of course, immediately after it happened. And, you know, many of our team knew colleagues who were killed, of course, so there's that additional pressure, because all the teams there are collaborating, working together, talking together constantly. There are daily meetings at the UN compound to compare notes, to coordinate, to share intelligence, etc. So there is that grief and shock. Also knowing that that trip, it was, the coordinates worsened. The relationship between that organization and COGAT and the IDF was a working one, we all thought, right? They didn't just rock up for the first time to do something. So the fact that that still happened to them definitely gives us, to some extent, the chills. And it, of course, it worries particularly our staff inside of Gaza. Now, we haven't suspended our work. We haven't evacuated international staff. I can imagine that some people might want to leave because of this, and then we won't stop them and we will facilitate that. But we are still intent on progressing the plans that we have in place, which is to do more, to get more supplies in, to start malnutrition treatment campaigns for children in particular, to help mothers feed their infants and young children, to start actually more mental health and psychosocial support activities, play and learn activities for children, because that is one of the biggest needs that we're hearing from communities, to make sure that we can also deliver food where possible and clean water where possible. So we're still still intent on scaling up, actually, our response. But yeah, a situation, an incident like this absolutely shakes everybody up and it distracts from us doing our job.
The mental health issues, obviously, with these people are enduring, especially of children experiencing this. And also, like you said, the aid workers that are grieving and fearful for their own lives and wanting to do good.
I spoke to a couple of doctors who came through and had done rotations there for a couple of weeks, also all the way more up to the middle of the Gaza Strip, where a lot of people from the north came through, still, you know, being displaced from the north. And I could see it in their eyes. They had horrific stories of having to choose, having to triage between children. Which baby are you going to put into the incubator? Because I only have one incubator. We have four babies. You know, which are the ones that we're going to send home to die? Premature babies, not enough space, not enough operational capacity in hospitals or maternity wards. And those are the choices that they've been asked to make. And no doctor wants to make that choice, of course, but they had to.
We appreciate you taking the time to speak with us about this. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. Thank you for keeping the spotlight on it.
Yanti Sirypto, President and CEO, Save the Children U.S. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. Heading to a Middle East already on edge, Iran on Friday issued another warning that it will retaliate against Israel for what Tehran says was an Israeli strike that killed some of its top military commanders in Syria's capital 4 days earlier. The commander-in-chief of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Hossein Salami, promised to punish Israel, which has neither confirmed nor denied that it was behind the Damascus strike. My colleague Michael Lippin spoke with Jonathan Speier, Jerusalem-based research director of the Middle East Forum, on Friday and asked about the significance of Iran toughening its verbal threats toward Israel.
First of all, I think we should remember that, you know, the killing of General Mohammad Reza Zahedi is a significant moment and a significant escalation in the sense that this is certainly the most senior Quds Force operative killed pretty clearly by Israel, you know, since the beginning of the war. So it is a significant step up. There have, by the way, been Revolutionary Guards figures killed earlier in the war already. Razi Mousavi is one, with another one as well, or a guy called Sadiq Hamidzadeh. But this was the most senior one. So it's a significant moment. The Iranians have not responded in force, carrying out retaliation for those previous killings. They have now threatened to do so in the case of General Zahedi. My own sense is that there has to be something. There will be a response of some kind, it's almost certain. But that does not in any way make it inevitable, as some people have been predicting, that, okay, this means the Iranians will open the gate now to an open war between Iran and Israel. You know, there's a whole lot of steps they can take other than that. They can, for example, activate one or other of their proxies to take a direct action against Israel. That's to say, the Houthis or the militias in Iraq could launch a drone or missiles at Israel, as they have already done on numerous occasions in the course of the war.
Do you think the Iranian side believes they can somehow deter Israel from potentially carrying out more strikes like what Israel is suspected of having done on Monday?
It's possible that they do, but I think also they regard themselves as in a kind of state of undeclared war with Israel. But the thing is that the Iranians have been conducting this war with Israel for some time. And the pattern of it is they usually like to fight using Arab clients. They don't like to fight using Iran. And that's why many people suspect that this retaliation, if and when it comes, will come from the Arab proxies. A cynical way of putting it would be to say that the Iranians are willing to fight to the last Arab. So, you know, it's quite possible that will remain to be the pattern of behavior. They're in, you know, this is not an isolated incident. This is part of a vast undeclared, or declared on the Iranian side, war, which has taken place between Israel and Islamic Republic of Iran throughout the region, and to some degree beyond the region as well, in other parts of the world, in Europe, in Latin America, and elsewhere.
So if Iran really is plotting some kind of retaliation through its proxies that it's been using for a while now in this conflict, what capabilities does Israel have to try to thwart an impending retaliation?
Well, both Israel and Israeli and Jewish facilities throughout the world are, of course, well defended, because attempts to hit at them didn't start this week. So it means that obviously Israel has, you know, extensive air defenses over the skies of Israel in terms of Iron Dome, David Sling, and the Arrow systems, which are designed to deal with both, you know, short-range and long-range missiles. and attempts at air attack. Jewish and Israeli facilities abroad obviously are defended by security structures which are in place for precisely a moment like this. So these are, we know, well-defended spaces, because Israel and the Jewish world, you know, is aware that it is subject to an aggressive attempt at its destruction by Islamic Republic of Iran.
Well, Jonathan Speier, research director at the Middle East Forum, on the line from Jerusalem, thank you for speaking with VOA.
Thanks very much.
And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you very much for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.